Japanese studies all show are fundamental things, fundamental aspects of human life, namely the fear of existence or the fear of death. When one teaches medical ethics, one is struck by the inability to clearly separate the various issues. And the way I usually separate them is simply by convenience. The issue of consent, the issue of death and dying, the issue of genetics, genetic screening, genetic counseling, and the ethics involved in such issues, and many others. But when one teaches medical ethics, one always finds that really the issues are not so clearly separable, and they all focus in on basic issues of human existence and human life. And generally, fear of existence and the fear of death is very much a part of that. So what these case studies that I will present in the first study, in the first part, shall illustrate is this basic fear of existence or the fear of death. In the second part, I would like to indicate some of the reasons which have been proposed why the medical establishment denies death. Part of the case studies is to show that in fearing death and fearing the fearing the basic openness of human existence, we fear and deny death. But the medical establishment fears and denies death also. And I would just like to mention a few of the reasons proposed by some people why the medical establishment fears and denies death also. And in the third section, I would like to give perhaps a brief theological interpretation of what this means theologically. But let me begin with a case study, some of which I'm sure will interest you very much and perhaps some less. A 27-year-old woman is a Jehovah's Witness and has a severe automobile accident and loses a lot of blood. You know that Jehovah's Witnesses are against blood transfusions because they believe that blood is the seed of life. Her husband is a very successful lawyer, and he doesn't know what to do, whether his wife's religious sensibilities are more important to him or his wife's life, and he decides that his wife's life is more important to him, and that he will deal later on, if she should be saved, with the issue of having violated her religious sensibilities. She recovers and is very happy to have recovered, and because of the conflict between her present happiness and her former religious feelings about having blood transfusions, she begins to study the issue. And she becomes more and more involved in being religious already, in the religious and the ethical issues involved. She decides to study for the ministry and becomes a congregational minister. And becomes a chaplain in a hospital, I must add. Very interesting case. For me, this illustrates how this particular case illustrates how a person can change, and how, in fact, change is a very important part in our life, and that persons involved in the medical field, physicians, nurses, or even relatives of patients, should take into consideration in advising their patients or in advising their relatives that possibly their opinion might change, and that this is very natural and very human. A film has been made, which is called To Die Today, one of the most striking films involved with genetically caused abnormalities. A baby is born at Johns Hopkins University Medical Center with Down syndrome. And one of the complications of Down syndrome is an obstruction sometimes. One of the complications that can occur in Down syndrome, that is commonly called mongolism, is a obstruction of the intestinal tract. That can be, if I'm informed correctly, operated fairly easily. It is not a major operation. But if the child with such an intestinal obstruction is not operated, he will die, because he cannot digest food. The parents had to be asked for consent to give permission for this operation, and they denied that permission. The basic issue here is euthanasia, another issue is consent, but I think basically, really, also at the root of this issue is the anxiety of existence, as was in fact the case also in the first case. The way in which the film, which was made by the Kennedy Center for Bioethics in Washington, the way the film presents the case is very realistic. The child is put into a little crib and is fed and is simply permitted to die by starvation. Issues which arise there is whether it would not be perhaps more moral to, if you decide for death, whether it would not be more moral to help the child dying, that is, to commit what is called active euthanasia and not only passive euthanasia, as was done in this instance. But what I would really like to center on tonight, on this case, for example, is the anxiety of the parents that made that decision. Not to center on the anxiety or the cruelty to the child that was expected to live perhaps 3 days, but the child, as a matter of fact, lived 15 days. Another very striking case was reported by a physician to the Hastings Center, which deals a great deal with medical ethical issues, Hastings on Hudson. After the Hastings Center had been founded in 1968, and after it began publishing some of the things with which it is concerned, a physician, an older physician in his 80s, wrote to the Hastings Center about his wife. His wife also was quite old and had become senile and had to go to the hospital, couldn't digest food anymore, was completely deaf and blind. And yet, when she was younger, she was very active in the issue of dying a death with dignity. And she was, when she was younger, on the forefront of the issue, when the nation as a whole didn't consider these issues very much as we do now. The woman had to be force-fed, that is, she had the proverbial tubes in her to get glucose taps so that she might survive. She couldn't do anything on her own anymore. In other words, she was kept alive artificially. The husband thought that this was a great indignity, and after considering her own statements about this kind of a life, in quotation marks, he decided that perhaps this artificial maintenance of life should be ceased. He went to the physicians, he discussed it with his son, who was also a physician, and the son disagreed. And he wrote all of this to the Hastings Center, and the correspondence was written up in the Hastings Center report. The son disagreed and took legal jurisdiction over his own mother. That is, his father's jurisdiction was taken away by court action, and the son was now the legal guardian of his mother. And he continued this condition of artificial feeding until who knows when, who knows what has happened. And I'm not quite sure what has happened. The correspondence stopped after a while, and as far as I know, the woman is still living. There are four cases which I have experienced myself, these others I have not, and I would like to mention some of these. One of the most striking ones occurred when I had this last semester, a clinical semester at the Albany Medical Center in New York. I spent my major time in two departments, in psychiatry and in pediatrics. And from the experience in psychiatry, I would like to relate to you two cases. Just to reiterate the basic theme again. In this case with Mrs. Morgan, there is also the issue of anxiety. In this instance, the anxiety was on both the husband and also on the son's side. Anxiety and the issue of death and salvation. For me as a theologian, these issues of death and salvation and anxiety and freedom from anxiety are always very important. But I sense, I very often speak to secular audiences, and sometimes I sense a certain resistance to them, and I'm very happy to be here where this resistance, I suppose, is not present. So I can come out with these issues and interpret them theologically. In the Department of Psychiatry in the Albany Medical Center, one night a man was admitted. I suppose he was about 57 or 58 years old. He was once, prior to his sickness, the assistant district attorney of New York State, one of the few patients who has a high degree of education and who has had a high degree of authority and power. He was diagnosed as schizophrenic, I think. It was not quite sure at first what the diagnosis was. The next morning, I always came in the morning, I never stayed overnight, I never went through that because I didn't have to. Only the residents have to do that. So I only came in the morning, and when the cases were presented, I was, like most of the staff, first confronted with the cases. When this case was presented, I thought he was very interesting. Because schizophrenia interests me. Schizophrenia is an illness that has certain social ramifications. That is, there are certain indications that schizophrenia arises not only because of biochemical disruptions in the brain, but rather might also be caused by social factors. Naturally, being a humanist, psychiatry interested me most. I would just like to relate to you one instance of dealing with this patient. Incidentally, it's very interesting also that I fully anticipated to come to the Department of Psychiatry as an observer, as I was in fact in pediatrics. I just observed in pediatrics, whereas in psychiatry something very different happened. Because therapy is necessarily conducted largely by words, not only, but largely by words. The way you behave and the way you talk and the searching for communication on the part of the patients is very prevalent. And almost inevitably, I didn't expect this, almost inevitably you are drawn into this whole setup. Everyone fulfills more or less a therapeutic function in this psychiatric ward at the Albany Medical Center where I was. And I think it is very similar in other psychiatric wards also. There was one psychiatrist who was assigned to this case, and she knew of my special interests and said, let's interview this patient. All patients that were admitted were assigned to certain psychiatrists, and were then interviewed as soon as possible after they had been admitted, especially if they had been admitted during the night. And I witnessed this interview. We looked for a room. If I understand it correctly, all psychiatric wards in the United States are overcrowded, or at least many of them. And so is the case. This is the case also in the Albany Medical Center Hospital Psychiatric Ward, which is a locked ward, incidentally. I should add that it's very difficult to convey a proper picture. You cannot get into the psychiatric ward just by opening the door. You have to get a key, and only the people who work on the staff have a key. And so I always had to open the door first with a key, and then I was inside. The people there are locked in, which is dehumanizing by itself, I think. And sometimes when I was standing inside the door and looked out through a glass window, which is plexiglass, I thought, well, maybe somebody standing outside looking in thinks that I'm a psychiatric patient. Indeed, when you're working in such a ward, this thought frequently occurs, because especially with schizophrenic patients who can be very intelligent and can carry on very intelligent conversations, you sometimes wonder what the content of truth is and what is fantasy in what they are saying, and whether perhaps you are a little bit deranged. In any case, we were looking for a room to conduct this interview with this man. And it was difficult to find one. We finally decided that we should take the major consultation room that we always used with the big group for the whole staff in the morning, because there was no other room available. This gentleman was brought from his room and was brought in. He had short underpants on with his fly wide open in the front, and had been known to undress publicly in this ward. Now, you must understand, there are many people there, and when a man like that undresses in public, this is a public place, yes, there is clear indication that that is of significance. He doesn't do that in vain. The man is completely intelligent. He has talked most intelligently and has had a far broader vocabulary than any of the other patients present. He was brought in with this outfit on that I have mentioned, and we looked around, and there were a few other people present, and we asked them to leave, except for one man, all left. And the other man who left was a much older man, I suppose he is about 85, who is a very sad case, rather senile, I suppose. I don't know what was the matter with him. He was not of great interest, and for that reason I don't know. In any case, he was sitting in the corner, not observing us at all. We asked him to leave, but he made believe as if he didn't understand anything at all. He was wrapping his feet in newspaper and just didn't pay any attention at all. And when we was our patient, this assistant district attorney of New York State, whom we wanted to interview, said, as we were asking everyone to leave, and as this gentleman was not willing to leave, "That's all right, he's my father. You can leave him there. The old man, he's really a good case. I mean, he's really a sad case, but he's really a good man." We sat down, and I think I had I was different. Nobody explained who I was clearly to the patients. That was fairly irrelevant. But they noticed that I was a new face and I was different, and I must also add that the day before, the night before, this particular psychiatrist had a situation with this patient. The patient's wife should come. It was asked whether the patient's wife could come to talk with the psychiatrist in care of this patient. But the wife was to talk to the psychiatrist alone, not in the presence of the patient. The patient, however, didn't want that. He felt very attached to his wife, and he felt very much alone being there all of a sudden in the hospital, and he wanted to go home. And so he was very jealous of this conversation between the psychiatrist and his wife. And that was the reason why he didn't talk to the psychiatrist and only talked to me. It's very strange how all of a sudden you become the center of attention, even though I was anticipated just to be an observer. So in any case, this man talked only to me. And what he said was really very amazing. He just talked. For about 20 minutes, he talked. And he said many things which I don't want to recount all now. In any case, he said that he's God. Now, he had said previously that the old man is his father. For me, this indicated that he believes that he's God and Jesus Christ. And I talked this over later on in private sessions with the psychiatrists, and sometimes they thought my enthusiasm for such interpretations went a little too far. But in any case, they were very interested in my point of view, which I found meaningful. This man had a clear theology. He understood, even though he had a legal training, he had a clear theology. He knew about God, Jesus Christ, and the devil. He knew about salvation, about original sin, the whole gamut. And it fit, everything fit together beautifully. But he was just continuing talking all the time. I just briefly, occasionally asked very short questions. And he was very content with that. Apparently he was replaying his role as a lawyer. Once, however, I begged him to interpret himself a little bit better. I asked a question that indicated that he was somewhat inconsistent. He immediately became quite angry and said, "How dare you contradict me? I'm God." And of course, I placated him and I forgot the issue. He just continued rambling out this schizophrenic world, and when there was no longer anything to say, no, that's not the way it was. It was not so that when no longer anything was to be said, but rather all of a sudden he ceased in his conversation, got up, went over to the door, like the Pope might. That was my impression, like the Pope or an emperor might all of a sudden get up and cease the private audience. This is the way this man all of a sudden got up, made an airy gesture, moved over to the door, stood in the doorway with his hands trembling. He said, shouted, his face got red, and he shouted, "And now I relieve you of the onus of being a devil, and I banish you to eternal hell." That's what he said. It was a very striking experience for me, as you can imagine. Well, you know, I am reading right now a biography of one of the great psychiatrists in Germany, Bürger Prinz, and he relates, it's his own biography, his autobiography, and he relates how he began being a psychiatric resident, and how it is very sometimes difficult not to chuckle at such occurrences as a young student in front of the patients, because they are so farcical and they are so funny. But they are indeed very serious, and sometimes I couldn't cease laughing, you know, just like you have. You know, I couldn't resist chuckling at what these people say, you know, outlandish things. But they are very serious, and underneath, I think, is a deep illness, usually. And if you don't take these illnesses seriously, I think you can't do anything with them. And then I perhaps should mention to you another case, which perhaps is even more striking. This gentleman, incidentally, was released, fairly well cured. He was chemotherapeutically treated with chemicals, with drugs, and he was released in a fairly good state of mind. And as far as I know, he was not readmitted. But another case, a young woman of 27 years of age, one day came in and also used God talk. Those were my special cases, when they used God talk, because they knew that I was theologically trained and had interest in these things. This woman also used God talk. When I first saw her in the morning after the day she was admitted, she was asked by the psychiatrist who interviewed her. He was the chief of service there, Dr. Grunberg. He asked her, "Well, what have you been doing?" Just to get the conversation going, he said that. It was merely a rhetorical question. And she said, "I've been counting the colored lights for God." And he said, "What have you been doing?" And she said, "I have been counting the colored lights for God." And he said, "What do you mean? Can you explain that?" And she said, she hesitated a great deal. She had been sleeping. She was still somewhat tired. She was annoyed by everybody asking her questions. And, you know, being interviewed too, that's not too pleasant a situation to be in. Usually such stories which patients tell are very private and are very personal. And if a psychiatrist asks about the meaning of such a statement, then the private life is entered. And that was one of the first things that came to my attention that the private life of these patients is pried wide open. What I was amazed at first also, as being somewhat questionable, is that they said, yes, go ahead, look in the records of these patients. But that is private information. But they gave this information to me freely. Of course, I had a special privilege because I had received a grant to do precisely that kind of work. But they should have at least told me that it is private information and that please I should please regard it as private. But that wasn't done. As a matter of fact, the whole staff talked constantly about the patients, partly also to be able to deal with the patients, because they are sometimes quite difficult to deal with. The statement, "I have been counting the colored lights for God," indicated also a schizophrenic situation. This woman, as it turned out later, I have had many, many sessions with this woman, and she has she was devoutly Catholic. It was Lent of this year, incidentally, and she had worn a little leaf. She was Catholic, very devout Catholic, and observed all the prescribed rituals by the Church. This statement, "I've been counting the colored lights for God," was a ritual which God had put upon her. I looked in the records, and the records indicated that when she was first interviewed, when she was first admitted, the interviewing psychiatrist during the night had written down that she uses strange language, but she talks clearly, but she uses strange language to describe what she is doing. The reason why she had been admitted is because she had been putting on a show, had been putting on a scene at her aunt's house, who was an alcoholic, and not too good an atmosphere to be living in for such a woman who has great difficulty getting along with herself. She had been putting on a scene at her aunt's house, had thrown chairs through the living room, and then had run out into the street and had knelt down in the street in the middle of the night and had prayed to God to relieve her of the goddess. Goddess is something, this is showed in the records, and later on I talked with her about it. Goddess is something, this patient told me, that God puts upon her. Something that she must do, like counting colored lights for God, but other things too. And she would be so obsessed with this. It was sort of an obsessive schizophrenia. Excuse me, I'm not a psychiatrist, but some of these... So if some psychiatrists may be in the audience, you may notice that perhaps I'm not using the language as it should be used. But she has had clearly an obsession, like counting colored lights. And she would have to do this for hours and hours until God gives her an up this it. This is how she called it, an up this it. God lifts, this is the way I interpreted it, lifts the got it away from her, so that she is relieved from the obsession. Well, after I got into that a little bit, I asked her about her faith. And I told her that I believe in God myself, and that I was trained in theology, that I was Protestant, not Catholic. I told her that too. And her face opened up, and she began to smile, and she was very happy about that, because this was very meaningful to her. One of the complaints which she said later on was that nobody understands her, nobody takes her religion seriously, and this is a great problem, I think, in psychiatric wards, and probably in hospitals generally, that nobody takes her religion seriously because obviously her religiosity, of course, is part of her sickness. This was also my main concern with the previous case about which I related to you. I took this man very seriously, but the others didn't. For them, as soon as somebody says that I'm God or, you know, something like that, that's obviously a sign of illness, and you cannot tolerate that. You must cure the patient of that. For me, the great question in this other case that I'm mentioning now, this 27-year-old woman, is the question, where is the borderline between legitimate religiosity and irreligiosity. And this is very difficult to single out. I think you must really be trained as a theologian in order to be able to tell that. Now, what became increasingly apparent to me was that she couldn't make a distinction between law and grace. This woman was constantly under the law. She was constantly oppressed. She felt severely insecure, and she also felt severely insecure over against God. And I told her, very simply, as I would tell anyone, I told her, look, you don't have to be afraid of God like that. If you really believe in God, then you must trust him that he also gives you freedom. God doesn't ask you to do all these things. You don't have to feel so anxious all the time. I interpreted that Christologically. I said, if you don't trust God like that, then you really don't trust, then you don't believe in Jesus Christ either. Because that's why Jesus Christ went to the cross. And if you think that you have to do something to placate God, for me, her Catholicism was very much in mind also when I talked to her like that. If you think that you have to appease God like counting, with things like counting colored lights and things like that, then you don't understand what the cross is all about. And for me, it was a sign of maturity that shortly after that, she just interrupted my statement and said, will you pray with me? And I prayed. I said essentially the same thing in the prayer. But she was very relieved, and she wanted just to be alone after that. I felt very good about that, because I thought that maybe I had gotten through to her. I must tell you that that was not the case. The former case was cured, not because of me, but because apparently of the lack of gravity of the illness. But this other case had a lack of personal identity. The woman, the 27-year-old woman, had a severe ego vacuum. She had no self-identity in essence. And I think, and the psychiatrists in Albany think, that she would be a psychiatric case all of her life. And maybe I should just mention about this woman that she has come from the area, from upstate New York, but has gone to California. I read all of this in her case study. Has gone to California, has become a Buddhist there. And then she went to Mexico. Apparently she went to some witch doctor in Mexico to help her have an abortion. Then she had a daughter a little bit later. She had a daughter who is now in Long Island, New York. She had that child when she was in a Long Island mental institution. And there she converted to Catholicism. Now, you see, for me, now this religiosity became rather questionable. The more I learned about the case, the more I understood that she had a severe lack of personal identity, and therefore she threw herself in the arms of almost any religion that promises relief. Buddhism was one, a witch doctor in Mexico was the other, and then Catholicism was the third. I suppose she came out of a middle class background, and I suppose she was Protestant because she had a Scandinavian name. I don't know how much longer I shall relate to UK studies. There are two case studies which I still have. I haven't gotten at all into the, it's already 25 minutes to 10 by my watch. There are two cases which I have from the Pediatrics Genetics Clinic. There is a Birth Defects Institute in Albany Medical Center where I have spent the other portion of my time. And I don't know whether you want to hear of two cases which I think are particularly of interest. I don't know how far we will get with the rest, which is much more theoretical, but let me just mention these two cases. I have seen many patients come in to Dr. Porter, who is the director of the Birth Defects Institute, a pediatric geneticist. And he counseled patients who have generally come in for genetic reasons. Sometimes a sickness occurred in their family due to genetic reasons, Duchamp's dystrophy, for example, and the fear has arisen in other members of the faculty, of the family, that they might also have this genetic defect, and therefore they would like to have they would like to be screened and counseled. Well, a woman came in with her husband, who had been a former nun, and she had married. She had left her order and had married. And a case of Duchamp's muscular dystrophy had occurred in her family, and she was afraid that this that she might be a carrier for this very severe disease. It always ends in death. So she wanted to be counseled. It turned up that the screening that they had done was positive. For me, this was, and also for Dr. Porter, with whom I talked about this case, it was a beautiful case, but it showed the whole agony of the human condition, I think. She was a former nun. She was, of course, still very Catholic, as most people who leave the Catholic order, having been nuns or priests, still continue to be Catholic and continue to be very religious. In fact, they leave it in order to be able to practice their faith in a different way and in a more fulfilling way for them. And as a Catholic, of course, she is very conscious of the issues of life and about abortion. But the way she sat there, Dr. Porter told her, the only way to avoid this, if you know, you can have, you have so and so many chances of having a child with Duchamp's, you can abort. Are you ready to abort if you have a child that is so afflicted? And she said yes. She went right along, but you could see that she said this only with great hesitation. That is, the hesitation had come much earlier, and she had thought this through. It was an issue of great concern to her and also to her husband. And then there was another case, a very much simpler woman. They had had a child, the woman was 33 years of age, and they had had a child with Down syndrome, and they came in for the first time after the child was born. The baby was only 3 weeks old. I saw the woman and the baby in her arms in the elevator going up. And it was obvious that the child had Down's syndrome, mongolism. And it was, again, very moving to see how very differently these people reacted. I had seen a majority of the patients that had come had had children with Down syndrome. One woman had come without her husband, but with her four-year-old mongoloid child. And was very fluent, was very verbal, was very much involved in the case. She said that she had accepted it and that she sent the child to special schools, but that the child doesn't talk. And the grandmother of the child was present too at this counseling session. And then the mother related how the grandmother and she always tried to get the child to talk. But constantly she was always indicating how she had fully accepted the fact that the child was a Down syndrome child. And she also said that at the special school, a teacher had told her that she had not fully accepted, because she was always trying to teach the child to talk. Children with Down syndrome usually have a retardation in development. That means that they go up to a certain level of development, and that level can be different. Down syndrome children develop to a higher degree. Most of them do not develop a full degree of intelligence and are retarded in such a way that they cannot go through the normal education process. For example, most of them, I think, if I'm informed correctly, cannot go to the university. In distinction to this other case of the four-year-old Mongoloid child and the woman who was really inside still rebelling very much against that, the indication of which was the fact that they tried to teach the child to talk, which the child was not ready for. In distinction to this case, this other woman of 33 with a three-week-old Mongoloid baby was shocked. And her husband also. Her husband was the one, I think, who was going to have greater trouble. He always sat there with his... He lit one cigarette after another, and he was drumming the table with his fingers and said occasionally, "How could this happen to me? How could this happen to us? We don't understand." Whereas the woman was listening to Dr. Porter and was, of course, obviously shocked, but I think that she's in a much better position to accept this condition and to be able to help the child as much as possible. But I don't want to go into the other reasons. I carry on 3 or 4 weeks on genetics and genetic counseling with my students, but I don't want to go into any of the other issues. I just wanted to relate to you some of the most striking cases that I have experienced and others about which I have read, in order to indicate to you how prevalent the situation of human anxiety and basically underneath that the fear of death lies. For me, as a theologian, the fear of death is squarely related to the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. If it is true, as many philosophers and theologians are saying, that man is different from the animals, insofar as man can set up his life and can structure it with meaning, or can despair if he does not find any such meaning. This fact differentiates us from the animals. And I think that many philosophers and theologians are correct in this analysis. But if that is the case, if death is ultimately the foe which we have to fear, then the death of Jesus Christ for our salvation becomes ultimately meaningful. And I would like, in this other section, if you have any questions, please ask me. If you would rather talk on about, continue talking about case studies and about any particular case that I have told or that I have told you about, I would be, or any other case, I would be happy to engage in such to conduct such a conversation.
I'd like to ask two questions.
Yes.
In relationship to the two psychiatric cases.
Yes.
One is how what the ethical issues were in those two cases, and the other is if you see the fear of death as the primary dynamic in those two cases also.
Well, schizophrenia perhaps is an illness that is, as I've indicated, at least some psychiatrists think that schizophrenia is not only brain rot, to say it very simply, as the chief of staff has indicated to me, it's brain rot. The man is simply, you know, is getting older, and in other words, there are biochemical changes in the brain which cause this disease. But many theories have been advanced that the content of the schizophrenic, the other world in which the schizophrenic lives, is very much related to the social world out of which he comes. Now, the second case clearly indicates that to me, in the first case too. The first case, the assistant district attorney was a man of power. He had lost that power because of his illness. I have neglected to mention that he had become ill at a certain time, which prevented him from conducting his high office. And that apparently caused him great distress. He was not really old enough yet to be retired. That apparently caused him great distress. And for me, there is a relation between the fact that he is God and behaved, in fact, like God and treated me like a man in front of God. To me, there is a relation between his profession and the fact that he couldn't execute his profession anymore, and this schizophrenic world into which he elapsed occasionally. For me also, there was a relation, and I engaged in this conversation with the psychiatrists, and I raised that issue, and they half-heartedly affirmed that the fact that he displays his sexuality, he masturbated in public, the fact he displayed his sexuality is also an indication for me of his lost power. He wants to make up that power that he had lost. And in any way in which he can do that, he was trying to do that. He went home fairly well cured. But the basic problem, of course, had not been overcome, because he had not become well enough in order to be able to go back to his work. In the second case also, the young woman who was under the religious compulsion, to me also that is an indication of this lack of relation to society and the inability to cope with society adequately, and her own experiences out of her previous life, and especially her religious convictions, had become the content of her schizophrenic world. Have I answered the question adequately?
No, I guess I didn't answer it very well. You were talking about the anxiety over death and the fear of death,
yes.
And I was asking if you saw that as a primary dynamic in the illness of the two psychiatric patients.
Yes, we identify ourselves, as for example in the district attorney, we identify ourselves with our profession. The more power we have, the higher we rise, the deeper we fall. And we identify ourselves with that. And for that reason, he had great anxiety indeed, no longer to be exercising his profession. And
Was he afraid that he had died or was dying? Is that what?
No, Heidegger, a phenomenological philosopher, says that behind human anxiety, Heidegger makes a distinction between fear and anxiety. And fear is the fear that we have every day of, for example, when I go up, hiking in the mountains, I fear I might sprain my ankle. Even dreams, nightmares that I might have are fears that emerge only on the surface, but deep underneath is anxiety. And behind all of anxiety is the basic fear of death, because death is the ultimate foe. We can do nothing against death. My wife and I were going up to Hot Lake. We didn't quite make it because we started out too late, but we saw there in the woods, coming back, and he was munching off the head of a little chipmunk, I think. It was probably a chipmunk, yes. Now, that chipmunk, I'm sure, has had great anxiety just prior to the moment of being grasped. But chipmunks, nor foxes, don't fear death. They don't fear death. They die in peace. They don't think of aging, like we do. But humans think of aging, and humans think of dying, and for that reason, the dynamics of dying are very important, and I was going to get into that a little bit. Kubler-Ross's five stages of dying, and I was going to highlight especially the fourth stage, namely depression. Animals don't have the fear of dying as humans do, and they don't know about aging as we do. I know that a great movement is afoot to protect the dignity of animals, and the attempt is made to bring up the animals to interpret animal behavior in conjunction with human behavior. And the reverse is true too. Human behaviorists like Conrad Lorenz try to show that human behavior is really nothing more than animal behavior. I know of those movements, and I'm very much in favor of being kind to animals. And still, for me, in my training in any case, I'm convinced so much of these theories that man can fear God and can fear the devil and can fear death. The whole Bible, I was going to say that, the whole Bible is full of that fear. The prophets know of that fear all along. That is the whole meat of history, whereas animals do not have any history. Animals live in the animal kingdom. Yes?
From a theological standpoint, I presume it doesn't look like afterlife?
No, I have not.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
You mentioned
yes.
Dr. Rock, I thought that.
Oh yes, that's her new book.
Yes.
Yes. No, I have not. I have read only reviews of it, but I do want to read it. Yes.
Oh, well, then the question will have to wait to finish reading. We have copies. We'd like to read it.
Yes. Thank you. I'd be interested to look at it. But what does she say there?
Well, I was just wondering about your theology from a theologian standpoint.
Well,
how do you accept that book?
Well, what I have read about the, I have seen this coming because I have read other things by Kubler-Ross and. She does make references in her other writings and also in her appearances. I have heard her several times, and I have seen her on television interviews, and I have seen her in a film that she had made, To Die Today, or On Death and Dying, I think the film is called. And yeah, and I must say that I'm a little bit puzzled. I have great hesitation. Right, I have a prejudice. I must read the book, I suppose, but I have great hesitation about these theories that a person can die or can be close to death and then can be revived again and then speak about death, and that as if that has anything to do with the afterlife about which Paul speaks in 2 Corinthians 15. There's nothing. No similarity. This is a different life. I brought my Bible in order to read that passage to you, just in case you might be interested, but it's totally different.
Thank you very much.
I must tell you a little joke. About two monks, and they didn't, they were very cognizant of the situation of dying, and they were afraid, and they made a pact with one another. The one who would die first should come back and tell the second, if he can, who had not died yet, how life after death would be. Whether it would be like this life, or whether it would be very different from this life. And so one of them died, and he was going to sleep, then the other one was going to sleep. And in his dream, the other monk, the brother who had died, reappeared. And in great fear and trembling, he spoke to him and he said, "Where?" He asked him, "Where? How is the other life? Is it like this life? Or is it like the other, or is it different like than from the life that we live now?" And the other monk answered, "Totaliter aliter, completely different. There's no comparison." And my teacher Thielicke has related this joke. I think it's not really a joke; it's sort of an anecdote. But has related this anecdote before here. I think, in fact, in this room, so some of you may have heard it before.
I have a question. Yeah. The mother with the 4-year-old Down syndrome child.
Yes.
You seem to indicate that because she was wishing that the child could speak,
yes,
or was trying to teach him to speak,
yes,
that she was not fully accepting.
Yes.
Could it be that she was accepting it, but she was looking for help and how to teach him to speak?
Yes. I must tell a little bit more about it, about that case. I was warned by Dr. Porter that if the husband came, that would tell me pretty much how the situation was. The husband railed, and the wife too, railed against the medical establishment. They were angry, they were so uptight that they railed against the medical establishment. And the reason why they did was because they just couldn't understand how this could happen to them. And the only way in which they could vent that anger was by being angry at the physicians. And this lies behind also the woman. The woman was very verbal and was talking all the time and knew every in and out, but you could see she was troubled. She was very troubled. And yes, I think probably she was trying to look for help, and she was trying. But now we have a two-year-old, almost a two-year-old boy now, and other children. That our son is 19 months old, and other children that are much younger than he talk. Our boy doesn't say, as far as I know, doesn't say one word. My wife thinks he says a great deal, but I don't. I don't think so. I don't hear anything, you know. I'm deaf, but we are not worried about that. Of course, we don't have a mongoloid child, but if I would have a mongoloid child, I think probably I would be even more open to wait. And I don't want to force anything on my children.
Perhaps there are people here that are more aware of this than I am, but
yes.
As I understand it, they are doing studies at the University of Washington where they are taking Down syndrome children at a very young age, and with the right stimulation, they are reading by the age of 3.
Oh, yes. Well, yes, we have in the Albany area excellent schools, and the Institute of Birth Defects. There are not many such institutes in the country. Albany is one of those places where they have such an institute. Is tied in. They are tied in with schools for such retarded children, and I haven't been to such schools, but I am told that they are just excellent. And that some Down's children indeed learn to read quite early, yes. But I have mentioned also that apparently the degree of retardation is different, and some Down's children, Down syndrome children, will never learn to read, and others learn to read and write quite early.
Do they ever learn to speak?
Oh yes, sure they do. Sure they do. They are just ordinary human beings, as far as I'm concerned. We could, for example, talk about the issue of abortion in relation to Down syndrome. You can prenatally determine Down syndrome prior to the child's birth if you think that the child might be a Down's. Because, for example, if the mother is older, say 43 or 44 or 45, we have had such women in the Birth Defects Institute. They are pregnant, and the incidence of Down syndrome children at such age increases dramatically. And then the women are told, yes, okay, you can have amniocentesis, a little bit of amniotic fluid is withdrawn from the amniotic sac, and cells from the fetus go into that fluid and can be investigated for Down syndrome. And if there is a Down syndrome, and if it is early enough in the gestational age of the fetus, it can be aborted. You could, that's one issue that we have not talked at all about here, and it is very much an issue relating to medical ethics. But I didn't want to do that because I had something else in mind. I had essentially the issue of anxiety, human anxiety, and the fear of death in mind, which is the reason why I raised these issues, and then I wanted to go on and to indicate some of the theories prevalent in Kubler Ross, for example, theory of why the medical establishment denies death. And then I wanted to give to that a theological interpretation to indicate how we could possibly overcome that fear of death. But I personally would never abort for a Down's condition, even though I am realistic enough to see that probably I would be shocked. And I probably would have, I don't know how I would react, frankly. But I don't think I would abort for a Down's child.
Excuse me.
Yes.
With regard to the book Life After Death, how do you interpret the attitudes, the feelings of those people who have experienced that particular trauma?
You mean Kubler-Ross's book?
Yes, you mentioned before that you had some feelings about it.
Well, yes, it sounds, I know I haven't read the book, I must say that. Again, I have read Time magazine review of it, I think. And also the way she talks in interviews, there is an indication that she thinks of life after death as a sort of a continuation of the spirit. After the body has died, the spirit moves on to another world, almost the way Plato thought of life after death. You know what Plato thought about death. Plato thought about death as a friend. Death should be the friend of all philosophers, because at the point of death, thought or the individual person draws itself together. I have a quote here in my notes, it's not necessary. I can paraphrase. It's not necessary for me actually to read the quote. The soul draws itself together and becomes actually the self that it is, and moves on into the real existence that it was. Only in a shadowy way during the real life.
In other words, the same entity that it was originally.
Yes, that's right. The life out of which it had come originally, Plato was influenced by the Pythagoreans, and this transmigration of soul is present in Plato's philosophy. That's an abstractness about which that's an abstract view of human a view of human life about which especially the Old Testament knows nothing. The Old Testament knows only about the bodily life and knows of no spirit apart from that bodily life. I'm amazed how with my students, I think many of them are Catholic, how prevalent this Platonic theory of the separation of body and soul is. They all think that. As far as I know, all students think that, especially the ones who are religious. And I ask myself, where do they learn that? And when Kubler-Ross talks that way, I think of occultism, and I think of this Platonic teaching, but I don't hear very much of the biblical teaching about this life and the life afterwards.
Don't you think that you might be placating those people who wish to believe that?
You mean, don't I think that one should possibly placate them?
Someone wants enforcement and she's merely enforcing that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that, yes. These people are rather young that I'm talking about, and they don't have great fear of death. Mm-hmm. But they have certain teachings in their mind. And for that reason, I'm usually free just to tell them the problematic about their teaching. But I have been with dying patients, and if they talk that way, I enforce what they think. I don't try to go contrary to what they say. If it is a help to them to think that way, in fact, Kubler-Ross says that in her book On Death and Dying, that ministers and hospitals and priests all too often are of no great consolation to the patients, and they have a fear to tell the patients what they believe in, even though the patient may want to hear that. You know, the kind of thing that as soon as Kubler-Ross begins to talk about religious matters and life after death, she talks in a rather simple way, in this way in which I hear my students talk, not in the way in which the New Testament speaks, in Paul in particular, that the body is completely transformed, but rather that there is a spiritual continuity. The physical body is sloughed off, and yes.
Well, it's referred to in her book as an out-of-body experience, but if you read the book in its entirety, she does not say this is entirely her belief. She recognitions many times, as feasts or incidents which have been related to her. It's given to the reader to make their decision as to whether they feel this themselves.
Yes.
And oftentimes when they mention the out-of-body experience, that too, without having read the book in its entirety or at least the full chapter,
yes,
you wouldn't have the full understanding. It would be completely out of context.
Yes.
To take just the verbalization of an out-of-body experience, which is the term used most often in the
yes.
book.
Yes.
To take that and just use that and look at it.
Yes.
Without reading the entire chapter.
Yes, of course.
There's many times yes. where you can go from many different experiences
yes.
in different ways.
Yes.
So I think it's very interesting if you have an opinion of it. Have you read the book like that?
No, but I've read some of the reviews too, and it would seem to me that it would be at least a possibility that these experiences which these people report, those experiences themselves could be culturally and socially determined.
That's what they said. There's many possibilities. It's just, it's not a fact, you know, it's not like, I don't say that this is how I believe it to be. I just think it's very interesting as a collective part of our beliefs and our feelings, philosophies, theologies, and whatever, to read some of these things.
Oh, yes.
And listen to them.
Oh, yes.
And take them in.
Oh, yes.
These, I don't know how many of you have been with Dalai patients that I have before, and there is a certain continuity, which, because there's enough of difference, and there's a certain amount of things that are the same, which you must at least think about these things and pray about them and be open to possibly the theology involved in them. And that's a possibility is there.
Yes.
It is that theology.
Yes, I choose not to think too much about that. I believe in the resurrected life right here. And who knows whether God is going to accept me in heaven or not? You know, some are accepted and some are damned, you know. I'm a Calvinist, I'm a Presbyterian. I don't want to carry that theme too far because, as a matter of fact, I've been much more influenced by the Lutheran theology. But I don't think that it is up to us to think too much about life after death. I think it is important for us to think about salvation here on earth. That's my position. And hopefully that makes me capable, and this is the basic point that Kübler-Ross really makes. Hopefully that, you know, once I know to be a trusting person, once I know that God is on my side, what else can happen to me, as Paul once says, you know, once I know that, then I hopefully can cope with the real crises in my life, and then perhaps with the little deaths, as Kübler-Ross, she doesn't say it just like that, but I interpret her like that. The little deaths that we die, the crises that we go through, having to say goodbye to certain segments of our life, perhaps certain prides that we have had, or certain lacks of successes that we have had, because she does say, those people who have great difficulty in coping with death when it comes are the ones who have had great difficulty during their life, too, in coping with crises. And those who have been capable of absorbing the crisis and going through them were also the ones who were fairly open towards death when it finally came. She has made a film, and at the end of the film, she interviewed a truck driver who had Hodgkin's disease, and I'm sure that he's dead now a long time ago. And she interviewed this patient. Medical students were looking through a one-way glass, were observing the interviewer. He knew that medical students observed. And then when the interview was over, she asked the medical students, well, what do you think? Has this man accepted death? He was only 28 years old. What stage is he in of coping with death? The disease had been diagnosed only 2 or 3 months earlier, and he was given, I don't know how long to live, but in any case, a very limited time. And the patient was very easy about it. He told a few things about his youth, about having gone to Montana or to some Western Canadian province to to live with his uncle there for the summer, and he revived some youthful experiences. He said, yes, I don't fear death. She asked him right out, do you fear death? And he said, no. And then in the conversation with the medical students, all of them, including myself when I saw the film for the first time, I had also thought that he was just putting on. 28 years old, with Hodgkin's, certainty of death, he's just putting on a facade, and he's really denying. And Kubler Ross's face was shown while these people told their opinion. And I was going right along with these students who were telling their opinion about this patient denying death. And then she said, no, I think that he is accepting. He is in the acceptance stage. And, I've read the book several times on death and dying. And she says most patients, never come to the acceptance stage. But some skip some stages. And for some patients, the stages are reversed. They don't go all in this chronological order: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. That's what my students learn, yes, in this clear hierarchy from denial down to acceptance. But as a matter of fact, many patients never go through all of them. They come right to acceptance, as this truck driver patient did. And so for me, to be in the hands of God means being capable to cope with crises, and means taking the resurrection of the body seriously, namely the resurrection of Christ's body into whom I am engrafted now. That means that the basic crisis has been overcome. How we are going now, what I would like to hear some of you say is, doesn't the basic psychiatric makeup, the basic psychological structure of your personality, isn't that more important than believing in Christ's resurrection? I indeed think so. I think that this is a very important factor. And I think that we can interpret the resurrection of Christ differently depending upon our personal structure. But some people can be more trusting than others. Some people are more fretting and more anxious than others. And this man apparently was not. I was struck by the way in which he was calm, this truck driver. He was very calm and very relaxed, and apparently, for me as a Christian and as a theologian, I'm asking myself, this man perhaps knows Christ, even though he may not be, he may be very far from Christ. It never came up in the conversation, but that's what Bonhoeffer means when he talks about the secular Christianity. That modern man can live without God and without Christ, and we should not be so blind to that. That was a great insight that I have had. I like Bonhoeffer a great deal, and I have gained a great deal of sustenance from him. But we should take that very seriously. Yes?
What would be your definition of medical ethics?
Well, ethos, ethics, of course, is meant originally in the Greek language, custom, behavior. It has come to mean moral action, moral behavior. Now, medical ethics is a sub-discipline of ethics, which is itself a sub-discipline either in philosophy or in theology. There's theological ethics or philosophical ethics. And there is, for example, in theological ethics, we have social ethics, we have political ethics, and we have medical ethics, we have ethics of marriage, legal ethics. There are all kinds of ethics. Now, medical ethics has become in recent years a very, very important theme. It deals with the ethical issues that arise in the realm of medicine. And it hopes to give some guidelines as to what can be done and what cannot be done. just like in politics or on legal ethics. Guidelines shall be given for the political realm or for the legal realm.
Now, you stated your stand on the Down syndrome child. How did you feel about the controversy between the father and son over the mother, the disposition?
Yes, I have sided there with the father, with the husband of Mrs. Morgan. I think that passive use of euthanasia should have been performed there. That is, she should not have been. The tubes should have been withdrawn, I think, and she should have been permitted to die.
Is there some danger of the lines being drawn at different levels in the medical
yes.
profession?
Yes.
For instance, take your schizophrenic young woman who, in the opinion, the best medical opinion, would never leave institutional life again. Is that any more of a productive life than the woman with tubes in her?
Oh, I should say. This woman is capable, very much capable of responding. Even the little things that I told you indicate that she was very personable. She loved to talk to people, and it was a pleasure to talk to her. What she could not do is live outside. She, while I was doing my residency there. She had been put into what is called a halfway house, but was back within a matter of days, because in a halfway house, which is sort of a way, an institution halfway between the normal life and the life in a psychiatric institution, certain demands are put, very minor demands are put on the former patients, certain chores, housekeeping chores and things like that. When to come in the evening and when to leave in the morning, and so not staying out all night, and you know, little minor things like that. But she couldn't even tolerate that. She needed the total institution. But within that total institution, she behaved very normally. That is normally within limits, I guess. I took her to the coffee shop. We had coffee with one another. We talked with one another. Don't you think that is more than this very old lady who couldn't hear and couldn't see and had no longer any meaningful communication with anyone or anything at all anymore? I mean, there's a great deal of difference between being personally very labile, being very flexible personally, like this 27-year-old schizophrenic woman. There's a great deal of difference between such a patient and the patient that is completely senile and cannot talk and listen and cannot communicate at all anymore, cannot express her will at all anymore. This patient expressed her will very strongly. I did not tell you a later stage in her illness. A couple of weeks after she had been in the halfway house and had come back, I talked with her again after I had previously many sessions with her. I had been away for 2 or 3 weeks. And I came back, and when she saw me first in the wards, I immediately noticed that she had a very different attitude to me. And of course, you feel, you know, she rejected me. I noticed that. She just rejected me. She came down the hall, and as soon as she noticed me, she sort of began slouching, had an uncertain walk, which she did not at all when I talked to her previously. And I talked to her, I stretched out my hand to her, said, "Hello, how are you?" And I mentioned her name. And she just briefly took my hand and withdrew it immediately and slapped me on the back of my hand and said, sort of frivolously and sarcastically put in a good word for me, will you? That is with God. I was very puzzled by that, and I went immediately to the psychiatrist and asked them what has happened. And they said, oh, now her big thing is sex, and she's put aside religion altogether. And as a matter of fact, I didn't mention, after she told that to me, put in a good word for me, there was already a guy, a patient, young fellow, and he was putting his arm around her waist, and she was, you know, going sailing right along. And that disturbed me, making the sarcastic remark, put in a good word for me, and sailing off with this young fellow, whereas just, 2 weeks earlier, she was so pious, and she observed all of the Catholic rituals, and she was so open and so friendly, but you know,
sounds like progress to me. That's better than counting colored lights for God.
yes indeed it's progress. But I must tell you of another case, just in case you want to hear, just another case which I could have told you. A 56-year-old man one night came in, and he was admitted because he had because the nursing home where he had been living couldn't handle him anymore. He was grabbing girls and taking them to bed with him. And now our psychiatric staff couldn't handle him either. And they were complaining about that during the night. You know, he was admitted to late at night, 11 or 12 at night. And our staff couldn't handle him, especially the young nurses. And so we had this debate about the ethics of this particular case, even of admitting him right away. Is this man a psychiatric patient because he grabs girls? Maybe he's just a dirty old man. And a dirty old man, I don't think, is necessarily a psychiatric patient. And so we had a big debate, and so we decided to have the chief of service, Dr. Grunberg, decided to have the patient write in and to interview him right there in our morning session, which we never do. And while the patient was obtained, I asked one of the nurses, what's the matter? Why can't you handle him? And the girl told me, oh, he is really impossible to handle. He gasses my girls, she said. Now, this was a supervising nurse. He gasses my girls. You know, they just don't know, you know, these little girls, these 22-year-old girls, just don't know how to handle that kind of a case. Well, the man came in, and I was firmly on his side, you know, that he was really not a psychiatric patient. You know, he was showing signs of health. They were a little bit strange signs of health. They were aberrant ways of behavior. But nevertheless, you know, he's not a mental patient. And the chief of service told me, well, if he is not ill, then we don't have to treat him. Then the law, then the police has to get him, because he behaves contrary to the law. Either he has to be brought to court, or he is ill and we have to treat him. And of course, I wasn't willing to have him gotten by the police either. So I guess he made his point. But my basic question was: is the patient ill? And then we had a debate about it. And after the patient interview, he just wouldn't tell anything about his youth. Apparently he had homosexual illusions or fears when he was a younger man, and also he was never married. There was also something very strange about the man. He became ill. He had diabetes, rather severe case of diabetes, and he became ill and a little bit senile and was brought into an old age home. But all along, he was supplied with prostitutes, which I thought was very interesting. But all of a sudden, he ceased looking at the prostitutes and started handling girls, namely the staff of the hospital, which we all thought was very funny. And strange, we couldn't decipher it, until one of the residents told me, yes, with a severe case of diabetes, impotence begins to set in. The man has become impotent. That explained everything to me. He had become impotent. He didn't want to see the prostitutes anymore. But to show that he's still somebody, he just made believe, as if he could, you know, as if he was still a man. And for that reason, he was here, all of a sudden became so obnoxious. Now, tell me, is he ill, or is he, you know, this is the meat of medical ethics. Is the man ill? Should he be treated? Or is he, is he organically ill, or is he psychiatrically ill? I mean, that he has diabetes, nobody denies, and that he is impotent, nobody denies. But his aberrant behavior, is that a sign of illness?
It's a deviant characteristic.
It's a deviant characteristic, yes. Now, should you treat him with drugs, or should you give him electroshock, or what they do there at the psychiatric center?
Hmm. Rolf, would you comment in this respect on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
I didn't see the film. I don't see many films.
What did they do with it?
I don't know. I left before I... I couldn't comment on this. Well, I think it's about time, isn't it? Oh, it's way past the time. I'm sorry.